For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Everybody knows me, but in case you don't, my name is Nyozon. The talk that I'm going to do this morning is We Are the Weather, is what I'm calling it. And I would like to start it with a quote from Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. He says, "When we practice Zazen, our mind always follows our breathing. When we inhale, the air comes into our inner world. When we exhale, the air goes out to the outer world. The inner world is limitless, and the outer world is also limitless. We say inner world or outer world, but actually, there is just one whole world. In this limitless world, our throat is like a swinging door. The air comes in and goes out like someone passing through a swinging door." In this passage, it's in a discussion of Zazen, and he's leading up to a particular point, a very interesting one that he makes about that, but that's not what I'm going to highlight here. The way he introduces this is by very sort of quietly and eloquently, in my view, asserting one of the fundamental truths of Buddha Dharma, you know, which we sometimes talk about as emptiness, but in the context here, I would rather use an alternative phrase, which we also hear often, non-separation. He continues a bit later on, "When we become truly ourselves, we just become a swinging door, and we are purely independent of, and at the same time, dependent on everything. Without air, we cannot breathe. Each of us is in the midst of myriads of worlds. We are in the center of the world always, moment after moment. So we are completely dependent and independent." He says here that we are dependent on everything. And I think that, you know, if we look at it, is relatively easy to understand. He does not say here the converse, but I think it's got to be equally true if we accept this Buddhist scenario of non-separation. That is, everything also depends on us. What we do and everything we do individually and collectively matters. But I think this is maybe harder to see and harder to accept. But the swinging door does not swing in only one direction. It's not its nature. Florence Kaplow was here recently. I was not here for her talk here, but she gave one at DePaul University as well, which I did attend. It was wonderful. And in that talk, she recommended five practices for cultivating a kind of steadiness and courage in our situation of climate catastrophe. These were, in sequence, facing what is happening, practicing not knowing, cultivating gratitude, slowing down, and taking care of one another. I think that talk will probably be posted on our site at some point, and I would really recommend it. But here, I would just like to say something about the first of these ones, facing what is happening, or not turning away from suffering. In Zazen, I think most of us will know that we become quite intimate, even friendly with, our own patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we begin to dissipate afflictive emotional states and delusive patterns of thinking through our practices of Zazen. Or that's the kind of one way of putting the sort of, theory of Zazen, if we're going to do that. In any case, I hope we dissipate those things and settle down and think more clearly. And we hope that by doing so, we will be enabled to be more supple and creative in our perception of and responses to the patterns of greed, hate, and delusion that we find in ourselves, but also those we find sedimented in our culture and society. Does this seem... You've heard this kind of thing, I presume. Part of me wants to go, yeah, of course. But it also strikes me that there's something a little bit fishy or deficient in this way of putting things. And that is that it's very, very dualistic, right? The door is kind of nailed shut. I'm working on my stuff in here and maybe also working on that stuff out there, or one or the other, or in sequence, or sometime, But it's problematic, because in this view of non-separation, we can say that those things are not the same thing, but they're also not different. Neither is not one, not two, not the same, not different. This is a pattern of thinking we see throughout the Buddha Dharma as expressed in sutras and so on. As Suzuki Roshi said, there's just one big world. The day after Florence Kaplow gave her talk, Sudesh Mukherjee, who many of you know, shared with me a bit from an email that she had sent to him previously in a conversation they were having. And I quote, and I hope it's not inappropriate to do so, "One of the things I tell people every time I speak is, I think this is still true, it would be interesting to do a little research on it. I heard this from a woman named Kathleen Dean Moore, who's an environmental philosopher who's written a lot about the moral dimensions of climate change. And one of the things she said at the conference where I heard her speak is that people have looked at the carbon footprint, comparing the carbon footprint of very strong climate change deniers and people who feel that this is really, really the primary issue, and there's no difference. So, what does this say about denial? Something is not registering." Something is not registering indeed. And closer to home, if we look at ourselves, people who regard ourselves as disciples of the Buddha, the way we live, in my observation, is sometimes almost indistinguishable from the lives being lived by the people around us. And in many ways, of course, that is absolutely fine. But in other ways, I also find this a little suspect, a little disturbing. Should we not be able to discern some visible manifestation of our practice other than the fact that, we come here on Sunday mornings rather than going to a church somewhere and, we put on this clothes instead of, a necktie and a suit, whatever it is. So, I wonder if there's sometimes a disconnect. Or let's narrow that. I see this disconnect in myself. Let's just narrow it to that. If we take the view that, I'm here and everybody and everything else is out there, it might be perfectly coherent and reasonable to think, it's a bit of a waste of time to pay too much attention to what I'm actually doing in my life from moment to moment and day to day. The thing to do, particularly when we're speaking about a so-called external issue like what's going on in our physical world, it might be reasonable to say the thing to do is to fix what is out there. And then maybe down the road, that at some point will involve me in making some personal changes in my own life. But actually, it seems like most of us act as though we, in fact, will never have to make any personal changes whatsoever. We can continue to use ever more energy year after year. And I don't just mean that, there are more people year after year, and therefore there's more energy use. I mean that on a per capita basis, all of us, you know, are using something like, 2.5% more energy each year. So year on year in 10 years, that's like 25% more energy. I mean, it's this ongoing process. We seem to feel that we can continue to eat whatever we'd like to eat year after year. I know that some people look at this closely, but most of us don't give a lot of attention to that, don't take a moment to reflect that some of the automobile trips that we make might not be necessary. All these kind of things. They're little things. They're the nitty-gritty of daily life. And in the face of what we perceive as big, big issues, they're easy to overlook. Most people I know would not hesitate to say, for example, that we have to work at a societal level to undo things like, racism or gender injustices, that kind of thing. And at the same time, do internal work to sort of undo, to the extent that we can, the delusive mental patterns or afflictive emotions that we've acquired in our culture that sort of function in a relation of mutual causality with these things. It makes obvious sense, right? There are these problems out there, and because I live here, they're here too. Need to pay attention at both levels. Yet when it comes to considering climate catastrophe, many people I know will argue that working on the small scale, on the personal things of affecting material changes in our own lives is kind of irrelevant, and at best a distraction. And some people, it's argued to different degrees, but some people just, I recently heard an environmentalist on British Broadcasting Radio, really sort of criticizing people who give any thought to that whatsoever. And I hear it expressed among my friends, things I read. So, greed, hate, and deluge. Chogyam Trungpa expressed those same three things slightly differently as passion, aggression, and ignorance. And, each has their value, but I think the different ways of putting what we call the three poisons, bring out different nuances. And I'd like to use that passion, aggression, and ignorance here because I think it brings out something. Florence Kaplow said in her talk at DePaul, "We seem to have a species-specific infinite capacity to avoid hard truths, to practice willful blindness." Bingo. So sometimes ignorance is more apt than delusion because it names a phenomenon not of being confused or befuddled exactly, but for the active, if unconscious, act of ignoring things. That is denial, not engaging in this first practice that Florence Kaplow mentioned of not turning away, really looking. And in the instance of something as enveloping as climate crisis, this is completely understandable in my view. It's a very hard truth that we are completely enmeshed in our social and cultural worlds and that the negative karmic predicaments there are also entirely our own, right? So day after day, moment after moment, we find ourselves sort of compromised and implicated in behaviors that we find it pretty difficult to justify if we think them through. And our awareness of that can be extremely uncomfortable, right? There's very little in our dominant cultural and social worlds that will support us in making any concrete material changes or sacrifices in our own lives. So it is much easier, actually, to pretend to remain, pretend to remain unaware. That is, to live in a state of ignorance, ignoring, and in effect, denying. And in this context, particularly what's happening here on the small scale, individually, et cetera, et cetera. To look carefully at my own laziness, say, my own lack of mindfulness in various situations and how I relate to things and how I use things. But I don't really see this approach as really very completely consistent with a life of practice, whatever that might mean. It is turning away from that in at least two ways that I can see. First, by refusing to carefully examine our own stuckness, our own karma, and our intimate karmic involvement with what we frame as our ecological situation. And I say ecological, you know, we frame this relationship as not an ecological one of mutual co-arising, dependent co-arising, that kind of thing, but as an environmental one. You know, I am here, everything else is out there, but because everything else is out there, let's work on that, fix that, and then it'll fix me. And in some ways that makes sense. So from that point of view, people are sometimes criticized for being too fastidious in their attention to personal behavior and trying to somehow, you know, be, you know, pure, you know, to like distance themselves, et cetera, et cetera. But ironically, behaving as if the problems are all out there also fosters a kind of, in my opinion, a false sense of a kind of purity, a lack of personal culpability and responsibility that enables a kind of, you know, blaming, finger pointing beyond what is helpful. I mean, sometimes you need to do that, you know. You need to say, well, in this swirling mess of problems, this is a focal point. This is a focal point. Let's do something here. But it goes beyond that often, I think. And that can foster, kind of nurture, a kind of an arrogance, maybe, a sense of a bit of superiority that is usually not warranted and is rarely helpful when expressed. On the other hand, while there is very little in the dominant culture that supports personal change and working at that sort of smaller level, we are not without guidance and support, you know, and the list is long. And if we look at things in what we call our practice, right? You know, later on today, some of us will be taking our meal in an Oryoki style, which the kind of underlying ethos of which is, you know, just enough. You know, be mindful, be aware, you know, what's needed in this situation in terms of movement and particularly in terms of what one takes into one's body. There's not a question of, like, you know, denying yourself, but there's a sense of, you know, what is appropriate to my situation here and now. We have the precept of not taking is what is not given. It's clear that the earth has and continues to be an abundant provider, but at what point does our own individual receiving become sort of collusive in what is essentially kind of a massive theft being perpetrated against future generations and, you know, all other beings, species in the world, against our own children and grandchildren, other forms of life? I think the practice calls us to engage seriously with these kinds of questions. And to do otherwise is yet another kind of turning away, of not facing not only what is happening, but how it happens. How, you know, we can say, You know, there are these bad actors in the world who kind of foster negative situations, but we're unwilling to see the way that we buy into it, we support it, and enable it. And I'm not saying this like we need to all be sitting around and like critical eye looking at each other and saying, well, you know, you're a little screwed up here and there. But I, you know, that's not particularly helpful either. But I think it is helpful to look at ourselves. In a recent book called We Are the Weather, from which I take the title of this talk, a fellow named Jonathan Foer says the following. Although it may be a neoliberal myth that individual decisions have ultimate power, you know, and this kind of ties into the image of Adam Smith and the, you know, the invisible hand working in a free marketplace, et cetera, et cetera. Although it may be a neoliberal myth that individual decisions have ultimate power, it is a defeatist myth that individual decisions have no power at all. And this strikes me as a pretty sensible, dare I say it, middle way approach. We need to work on all fronts. Yet in some corner of practice, the questions of power and being effective, all that is kind of secondary. You know, and I wish there was time to spell this out more, but, you know, for example, in Bodhisattva practice, we vow to save all beings. We don't do that because we have some kind of illusion of omnipotence or because there's not always going to be another being to save or another delusion to live through, but because our sort of awakened heart, you know, or however we want to talk about what happens in our practice, calls us to do it. That's how we... That's how I choose to live, and that's part of my understanding of what the Bodhisattva vow is, and realizing that I not only have that vow moment after moment, but that I'm failing moment after moment, but sustaining myself in the effort, and hopefully through sustaining myself, sustaining others as well. So let me close with this koan, which, again, Francis Kaplow brought it forward last week. It's from the collection The Hidden Lamp. And it involves a laywoman and a teacher. Laywoman's name is Ling Xingpo. Ling Xingpo visited Master Fubei Heshang to pay her respects. They sat down together and drank tea, and she asked him, "If a true word cannot be spoken, no matter how hard you try, how will you teach?" Fubei said, "Fubei has nothing to say." Ling was not satisfied. She placed her hand inside the opposite sleeves of her robe and cried out, "There is grievous suffering even in a blue sky. To be a human being is to live in calamity." In this story, at least part of how I understand it, Fubei is kind of chastising, Ling Xingpo is kind of chastising or rejecting Fubei for a kind of turning away. You know, what can be said when there's nothing to be said? What can be done when there's nothing to be done is somehow maybe not ever going to be adequate to just sort of say, nothing to say, nothing to do. So to be a human being is to live in calamity. The skies, suffering. Grievous suffering, even in a blue sky, is our suffering, and our suffering is the sky's suffering. As Suzuki Roshi said, we say inner world or outer world, but there is actually just one whole world. Right? So you know, I would invite us to turn towards that inside, outside, in between, doing our best to cultivate a kindness and awareness in all those situations, and not pick and choose between inside and outside and all those kinds of things, just, you know, turn towards it. So I'll let it go there. I'm sorry that was a bit long, but we have some time if there are any comments, and we'll have a for those who are staying through the day, we'll have some period later during tea. Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think what's was referred to, what Foro was referring to, is this neoliberal myth, is this kind of idea, for example, that, you know, all that is needed to affect some kind of adequate or something approaching an adequate response to the situation are in are for, you know, people to, you know, make different consumer choices, say. Different consumer choices. You know, if like we buy the right stuff and eat the right stuff, those problems are going to be taken care of. And, you know, kind of like the magic hand, you know, it's like people act selfish, the invisible hand, magic enough. You know, that if people just sort of pursue their own interest in a sense, that things will sort themselves out. So, you know, so I'm trying to suggest, I don't think it is that. I don't think that it's ever going to be that. You know, the choices we make individually are not going to sort things out on their own. But it's also not that. That's got to be part of it. That's how, you know, I mean, when you think about other sort of major social changes, you know, at some point, you know, things do have to be addressed and ironed out at kind of a political, kind of communal level in a very sort of conscious sort of way. But that doesn't happen, perhaps, until many, many people are sort of saying, no, this way of doing things is not working for me, you know, and I'm going to start living differently. And that becomes a condition that sort of, you know, maybe in some sense then fosters or enable to being able to have that more sort of macro level approach. But there's a dialectic. It's like you know, fanning, you know, the nature of the wind extends everywhere, and that involves continuing to fan, for those of you who know that reference. Bo.
I really appreciate this talk. I'm thinking about a lot of stuff too. And it just reminds me of, and what Dylan said too, reminds me of, there was around the climate strike in September, you know, there was an image of Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old maybe, Swedish girl, who, I mean, there was two images, one of her on one of the first days of her strike, which she just initiated on her own. She decided to miss school and go. I'm not sure if she went to City Hall or the Parliament or wherever.
Parliament.
But there was a photo of her, like, sitting there by herself. I mean, that, she did that. Like, along with, I know she made other sort of individual changes, flying less. Obviously, she's, like, taking boats around the world and stuff at this point. But then the image next to it was, like, of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Madrid, like a year later or whatever, you know. And that day, the climate strike day, millions of people marched around. Initiated, you know, I wouldn't argue, like, every individual action ends up with, like, millions of people doing the same thing. But, I mean, to me, that was really inspiring. It was, like, an individual act that kind of blossomed into this. And I'm sure she wouldn't have predicted when she took that act that it would turn into that a year later. But, you know, she clearly, disturbed by the situation, not knowing kind of what to do, did something and turned into this really amazing, and continues to be this kind of amazing movement led by young people. So,
yeah, she's amazing. You know, and it's interesting in that particular case, we can, you know, it's one of those times when we can sort of identify something clearly, like, you know, Greta Thunberg did something and people responded, and we can sort of draw a line. And in most of the things we do, we are not able to clearly trace out the consequences and effects in that way. But that doesn't mean that there are no consequences and effects. We should act in the confidence that everything that we do does have consequences and effects, and that therefore we should, in all our activities, do what we can to sort of do what we can to assure that those are beneficial and wholesome effects. Asian. Yeah.
It's you can get a cheeseburger and fries for $1, and especially in neighborhoods that are at a real economic disadvantage, sometimes that's the only, you know, food that's readily available. And it's the same with, like, driving cars. You know, it would be much healthier for us to walk or bike or but much cheaper. You know, but so we're kind of, well, that's. So that's sort of the opposite. But it's bad for the environment for us to drive everywhere or fly everywhere. And it's not good for us either. It's not good for our health. And I don't know, it just continues to amaze me that it does require a complete mind shift for, you know, for everyone. And it's on so many different levels that it can just feel overwhelming. You know, I was at a party last spoons and red Solo cups, and I'm just like, you know, these are such wonderful people. Why are they doing this? How do I stop? It's so hard,
and everything sort of, you know, there are lots of forces, some inertia, some through very deliberate efforts to sort of sustain these things, but we're all completely tangled up, and so people have, you know, different responses. And so, for example, you know, this thing with food, you know, and you know where there seems to be, you know, particular, you know, it's very unfortunate that, you know, some of the people who will suffer most from eating terrible food are eating terrible food, right? You know, but that's not out of the blue. There are all kinds of forces that sustain that. And so we don't have to involve ourselves, I don't think, you know, we can sort of see that as like, well, this is something to work with and, you know, try and find ways to change that situation. But we don't need to involve ourselves in any sort of judgment about the choices that other people are making, per se. But we can sort of start working around the edges. And it's like, okay, you know, some people, you know, you hear these stories of some guy in Alabama who's walking 20 miles to work every day because he doesn't have a car. You know, maybe we have a car and we have the option of like, well, you know, sometimes I could walk, you know, and we make that choice, you know, where we do something where we can do it. You know, and we sort of gently, you know, nudge our friends to say, you know, it's not really that big of a deal to rinse out 20 chili bowls. If you've got the bowls there, some people don't. They're going to eat out of, you know what I mean? So it's a fine thing. There's a real danger about getting very judgmental about what other people do. But on the other side, we can safely evaluate what we do and be mindful. And
yeah, I think, you know, what you're saying though is, you know, we do need to watch what we do, because that is one piece of it. It's not enough, but you know, as it becomes more commonplace for people to think about that, maybe I should walk. It just can affect change. I used to throw a everybody loved like all the stuff, and you know, they'd be like, "Oh, can I get your recipe for that?" And I'd be like, "Sure."
It's like,
so you know, we can help to change things without, you know, beating people over the head with it.
Yeah, or even beating ourselves over the head with it. I mean, there's a fine line there too, right? It's like, yeah, the way this thing came up, where Florence responded to Siddesh, was he had written her this thing, and it's like, you know, we're at this thing, and as it happened, it was at DePaul University, and you know, he was specifically saying, well, it's like, I was a little stunned that, you know, all that was available there were these little plastic cups, what single-use things, and every, you know, a number of people, including myself, including her, you know, had a glass of water and then threw it away, and he's like, you know, you need to think about this, you know. And we're kind of getting short on time here, so if there are any one or two last, David?
Freedom Riders, and it created such a monumental shift across the country just to have these few people going out there. And then all of a sudden it was visible, and the civil rights movement just took off. Mm-hmm. It's something that was just so horrible. The lynching of people just because of the basis of their color. They're not being able to vote because of the basis of that kind of just dissipated only because a few people were able to be out there and to demonstrate. And like you say, if you go to the party and somehow say, yeah, maybe next year we could have some plastic, non-plastic bolts, but real bolts in Washington. And like I do at work, on my own, using a real spoon instead of the plastic stirrers for coffee, and set out a bunch of real spoons there. That little thing can maybe spark other people to think about it as well. It kind of gets contagious, and as it grows, maybe we're all more connected.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's very important. For me as a person, I have to be the example of the way to be, so to speak, not because I'm older than that, because that's just the way to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm a little bit. I would hesitate to think of myself, for example, as an example for anybody else. Exactly. You know, I'm happy if something that I choose to do encourages somebody else to do something positive. But yeah, it's things are complicated. We do not, you know, as that's why Fubé says, I've got nothing to say, you know, he's in this impossible situation. But I don't want to, you know, I wouldn't want to say, I mean, for example, your example of the Freedom Riders, it's not like a few people did something and then everything dissipated. It still hasn't dissipated completely. But, you know, people did something, there was a response, you know, people all around the country or Greta Thunberg started doing things, and things moved in a positive direction. So, we need to think that, you know, we need to do what we can, you know, in our own, I mean, what I'm trying to urge is that we do what we can in our own lives and see, you know, part of what we do in our own lives, hopefully, is also being, you know, going out to demonstrate, writing our congressman, acting together. Because we don't know how things work, and we need, as I say, we need to, I believe, work on all fronts. One last one, or shall we stop? Okay, we'll stop. Thank you, everybody.